From WJCT Studios in Jacksonville, Florida, I'm Ray Hollister.
I'm Kevin Clark.
I'm Aaron Edelson.
And this is Deemable Tech, the show that brings you the latest news in tech, computers, gadgets, the internet, and social networking. And then we answer your tech questions. If you need help with your desktop, laptop, tablet, or mobile phone, we're here to help. If you have a question that you want to ask Deemable Tech, give us a call at 904-372-DEEM. That's 904-372-3336. Or you can send us an email at questions@deemable.com. Post a message on our Facebook wall at facebook.com/deemable. Or send us a tweet at deemable. Well, Google was the big newsmaker last week. Google held its big annual developer conference that they call Google I.O. For input and output at the Moscone Center in San Francisco, the same place that Apple held its Worldwide Developers Conference a few weeks ago. And the biggest, kind of the most exciting thing that happened at the conference was, whatever you can say about it, it was not boring. Google co-founder Sergey Brin interrupted a keynote presentation on Google Plus to show a live first-person footage of skydivers in wingsuits jumping out of a Zeppelin and landing on the roof of the Moscone Conference Center.
It was pretty impressive.
Yeah, it was really amazing. The entire time they were connected with the crowd so that the crowd could see what they were doing, and this was all live. It wasn't a stunt. Well, it was a stunt, but it wasn't a pre-recorded stunt. Everything was live connected. It was really awesome. You could see everything they were doing. And how is the skydivers were wearing Google Glass, the experimental Google technology that allows, among other things, users to transmit live video of what they're seeing.
I think the fact that they did it as a live stunt rather than a pre-recorded deal is really kind of says a lot about how far Google's come as being able to do something like that in live and be able to pull it off successfully like they did.
Yeah, absolutely. And they kind of appealed to the geeks in the audience. The next day they did the exact same stunt all over again, except Sergey showed the audience how they did everything in it, which was really fun to watch and to see how they did it. But the attendees got to see the skydivers jump out of the Zeppelin, which the whole premise behind it was that they had Sergey's Google Glass and they needed to bring it back to him. So they jumped out of the Zeppelin, landed on the roof, handed off their headsets to a group of extreme bikers who then turned it over to some guys who rappelled down the side of the building. And then finally another crew of bikers wearing the devices rode into the Moscone Center and onto the stage to thunderous applause.
Pretty impressive show.
Yeah. And it was a great stunt. But like you were saying, though, it does show like what they were able to do. And to do this all live was pretty impressive.
I mean, you'd expect with something that revolutionary and that kind of groundbreaking to have some sort of hiccup in the...
Yeah, and the
demo.
There was just a moment of, you know, where there was a little bit of break in the video, but considering it was all live, falling out of a Zeppelin, that was pretty amazing. Or a blimp, you know.
You're not walking from one end of the Moscone Center to the other. I mean,
yeah, exactly. And the neat thing is, you know, that these devices, the Google Glass devices, they're lighter than most sunglasses, and they're really designed for quick sending and retrieving of information without the getting in the way of the user, is what Google said about them. Kevin, do you know, can I buy these now?
You can't buy them, but they did offer to sell them to the developers for $1,500.
Yeah, that would be fantastic. That's definitely, and they're still really in the experimental stage.
Sure.
I mean, this is not something that's ready for the general consumer yet.
Well, obviously, even though the technology is there, you got to have the developers on board to build software to use such
a
device.
Very true.
Just the basic device itself really isn't going to get far with the general population until the developers get on board and start making things that the average non-skydiving user would find useful.
Right. Yeah, and the ideas for what Google Glass will be able to do kind of reflect what Google Now does, which we'll talk about later. But there are a lot of ideas for what Google Glass could do. So if the developers get a hold of it, you know, and they can make some amazing apps for it and make it do a lot of magic.
I can think of a lot of, you know, real world applications, you know, besides all the fun that they, you know, displayed at the conference. I mean, I could really see it being used for, you know, law enforcement and even military application.
Yeah. And just to clarify for our listeners, because we didn't really jump into this, is the Google Glass is literally a set of glasses or glass frames where you can see data and transmit data from them.
It's a live stream.
Yeah.
You know, a video. So you can see what the viewer is seeing.
Right.
And, you know, I think they also have sort of like a augmented reality type
right.
of monocle that they can see, you know, certain
well, and I know
data.
I know we're going to talk about it in a little bit, but, you know, coming up with the Google Now and services like that, I think that once these do really hit the shelf and consumers are able to get them, that you'll see services where, you know, when you walk around, it'll automatically populate information into that little screen for you.
Right,
so you'll be able to see what you're doing as you walk around. Hey, here's a restaurant that you would like. It got good reviews.
Yep.
Here's the subway station you were looking for up ahead.
Because in addition to people being able to see what you see, the wearer can also see information as well. So it's kind of like having an Android phone on your face.
That's pretty cool.
So the other big thing that they announced was, and this kind of encompasses everything that they did at Google I.O., which was the next new dessert from Google, Jelly Bean.
Yum, yum.
Finally, we thought it was going to be called Jelly Bean, and that's what they decided to call it.
Another sweet treat for us to munch on.
Another sweet treat, you're right. And it's Android 4.1. Unlike Microsoft's big announcement, most of the phones will be getting it. That's the plan, at least. There's no major plans to leave people out, fortunately. One of the nicest things, as an iOS fan, an Apple fanboy that I am, one of the things that I was the most excited about is Project Butter. So I guess it's a butter-flavored jelly bean, like they have at, what's the jelly bean place?
Jelly Bellies.
Jelly Bellies, yeah. So it's a butter-flavored jelly bean. But no, Project Butter is a project that they did at Android or at Google to make Android smooth. And so there's no more jittery transitions. One of the complaints that I had when I played with Android was it just felt a little like it wasn't working right. I mean, it was working fine and it was working fast, but they didn't design it so that it looked great. And Project Butter is really going to be changing that. One thing that they did is they made all the animations, the closing and opening of apps and, you know, opening of menus, they all run at 60 frames per second, which is pretty impressive. But what's nice is that all of them run at the same speed across the board. So they showed a video at 300 frames per second of one phone running Jelly Bean, Android 4.1, and another phone running Ice Cream Sandwich right side by side. And you could really see the difference. When they tapped the same button on Jelly Bean and ICS, or Ice Cream Sandwich, it was so much smoother on Jelly Bean. It just smoothly transitioned out, whereas with Ice Cream Sandwich, it was kind of like, and a little jittery. And
even Ice Cream Sandwich was probably pretty impressive compared to the older versions.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, it's not like
compared to Honeycomb and Gingerbread,
yeah.
it's a big difference.
It wasn't just some chump of an operating
and
system.
It really is only the user experience. I mean, it was running, they run comparatively the same, and they run really good, and it's on good hardware. But the user experience, for me, if it gets jittery, there's something wrong with it. It's broke.
And it shows, how much Google is paying attention to what other people are doing and to what other people care about. Obviously, the iPhone users, you know, care a lot about that smoothness and how beautiful it looks.
Yeah.
You know, you have a really nice, smooth user experience, and the Android users are saying, hey, our hardware's there, the operating system's there, why doesn't it look as good?
Right. And they did something, too. They added it, or they made it where when you touch the screen, basically all of the processing power of the device focuses on what you're doing. So it may be ramped down to a slower speed because you're not using it, but as soon as you touch it, the entire power of the processor is right there.
Which that's going to do a lot for battery life off the bat, because I know a lot of people are going to be, you know, curious as to the quad processors versus the dual and single cores. It's a lot more processing power. It's going to be draining from somewhere.
Yeah. Now, let's talk a little bit about the other big announcement, which we kind of alluded to a little bit when we talked about Google Glass, which is Google Now, which is?
Well, of course, you know, Google Now coming soon. They do have the website live, but we're still waiting, except for those select few that have gotten
the jelly bean. The irony, Google Now coming soon.
Exactly.
Not right now, but now.
soon.
It's going to be a kind of a new assistant of sorts, but it's going to be a little bit different than Siri.
Yeah, it's going to be a little bit more proactive instead of reactive. Whereas Siri, you ask it questions, it gives you information. This, the information appears on your phone when you need it. So, for example, when you wake up in the morning, a weather card appears so you know how to prepare for the day.
And then when you're ready to go to work, it gives you traffic information for the route that it knows that you take. It's very interactive with your schedule.
Because it knows where you're going to work and what route you normally take, so it checks it for you. Also, if you're like me and you take the bus, it will tell you when you arrive at the station, when the next bus will be there. Or if it knows that you normally take the bus, it'll let you know how far away or how much of a walk it's going to take to get to your bus stop.
It'll even tell you when you need to leave your house so you get to the bus stop on time.
Yeah.
And which could be very useful if you're in a new city. You know, you visit New York, visit LA, Chicago. You're unfamiliar with their transit systems.
Yeah, like here in Jacksonville, unfortunately, Jacksonville Transportation Authority is still not using Google Maps, but that's another gripe I'll deal with later. But in other cities where they do have it, that's a fantastic feature. Also, one of the things I thought was interesting, when you have an appointment coming up, Google Now will pull up a link with directions to the location, and it will check directions to that appointment. And it'll check the traffic on that. So you can figure out, okay, well, I don't normally drive that route, but Google Now knows what that route is and says, oh, there's a traffic accident. You need to go a different way, which that's a fantastic feature too.
It's pretty impressive.
And then a couple of other things. When you're traveling, like out of the country, it will provide a currency translator or currency converter and a translation app. So if you're in Germany, it'll just give you English to German translations and translate it to the euro.
One thing I really liked about it was that it has restaurant suggestions and things like that, but I'm the kind of guy that I like to try new things. So when I go into a restaurant, I want to know what's good there, what haven't I had before. And it knows, if you're at a specific restaurant, what that restaurant is known for. So you don't have to ask the waiter all the time.
We'll talk about that more. We got to take a quick break. This is Deemable Tech. If you missed an episode of Deemable Tech, or you just want to hear the show again, you can catch our podcast on our website at deemable.com/podcast. That's deemable.com. Also, be sure to follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/deemable, or on Twitter at deemable. You can also find us on Google+. Just search for Deemable Tech. Welcome back to Deemable Tech. Before the break, we were talking about Google Now, one of the new features of Google Android 4.1 that was announced at Google I/O conference last week at the Moscone Center. One of the other things that they've added, or that they are going to have as a card in Google Now, is you mentioned before the break, food. Mm-hmm. For restaurants and bars, when you're out on the town, it'll give you suggestions of places that you're at. That, when I first saw the news, that was one of the things I was kind of like, I don't know if I like that. Because my concern was, I'll be walking down the street and they'll be like, oh, over here, there's this. Over here, there's this. And it's a bunch of annoying ads. Mm-hmm. But as we were talking about before the show, Aaron, that, you know, you don't have to have the Google Now app open.
Absolutely.
You just have it when you want it.
Something you could turn on and off. So if, you know, if you're going out doing your normal business stuff, you may have it off. But if you're going out on a night, you know, night on the town, and you want to experience the nightlife and see what new stuff is out there, yeah, could be very useful.
Yep. Also, one of the features of Google Now is when you're at the airport, or if you've recently searched Google for a specific flight, the flight card will appear and show you relevant information about the flight. So, for instance, a friend of mine came to town recently. She was out in Africa. She flew into town, so we searched on Google for it, for her flight, to find out the details of when it was coming in. And with this, when we showed up at the airport to pick her up, boom, that information would be right there. So it's kind of like Passport, with Apple's Passport that they announced at WWDC, but actually a little bit further. Because with Passport, it just shows if you're taking the flight, it would pop up. But this will actually show, hey, you searched for this flight, it's about to pull in, maybe you need that information right now.
And, you know, after listening to the conference, it really, I'm not sure about this, but it sounded like it kind of interacts with your calendar,
right,
in a way. And so if it knows that you have a flight coming up, but it'll tell you that your flight was delayed, it might recommend, you know, switching your calendar around to do things you might have done if you didn't have that flight.
That was something that impressed me. Like, you know, normally at this time you do this, but you had something planned. But that you can't do that now, so let me readjust things for you. Mm-hmm. And again, it's that whole being proactive instead of reactive thing.
Well, and they're tying it back into their other services, like you were mentioning with the calendar. Google likes to build on their existing services rather than try to reinvent the wheel with something completely new. So if they want to do something assistant-based, they're going to tie it into something they've already built, such as their calendar features and their contacts and things like that.
Now, one of the features that I don't particularly care about, because I don't really follow sports, but if you've searched for a certain sports team, it'll keep track of that information for you. So if you search for the Jaguars, because we're from Jacksonville, you know, you search for the Jaguars and the Jaguars score a big win, it'll pop up with the sports card and show you that information.
And I'm guessing it'll kind of do a similar thing for movies and entertainment. If it notices you're searching for movie times for a certain, you know, movie around you, it'll start, you know, populating, here's the nearest show times we've detected for you.
Right.
And it knows just because you Googled it.
Yeah, exactly. Which is kind of, that's kind of, you know, it's using a lot of information, which will make some people uncomfortable, but
that's a good
it's
question.
Kind of great. I mean,
what really, you know, do you want them knowing, and what really do you care about people knowing?
Right.
And that's kind of the new conversation. Is it's not so much what you're sharing with these search engines like Siri. You know, they've had a lot of issues about them collecting data, and
sure,
that's starting to come out in the news. And now you have this, which it's Google. They're going to collect, you know, not necessarily your personal information, but you were searching for this, so they're going to put down person A searched for this stuff. So they're
right,
going to be collecting some information, but it's going to be on things like where people are looking to eat, where people are taking flights.
True. And you, with Google Now, you can always decide what you share. You don't have to share your location with it, but you can. You don't have to share your search results with Google Now, but you can. You get to opt out of those things.
Exactly.
Or some other features that they talked about.
Well, Google Now is definitely a big feature, but I'll tell you what, I think an even bigger feature was the addition of the offline voice typing, where before you actually had to have, you know, an internet connection to be able to do any kind of voice typing and be connected to the Google servers and such. But now they've actually made it small enough and put it inside the phone. So even if you have a bad, you know, internet connection, you can still do that voice typing that
people
want.
Yeah, that is one that I am definitely seriously jealous about. you know, making the obvious pun there. No, for real, this has been one of my biggest complaints about iOS adding dictation. It's great, and Siri's wonderful, but if I don't have an internet connection, I've got it's useless. It doesn't do anything,
mm-hmm,
because all of the even basic transcription is still processed in the cloud. So if I don't have a strong 3G connection or a Wi-Fi connection, I'm back to typing on the keyboard.
Well, I definitely think that was a great move. And to your point, I mean, I have the same issue with Android. It's great on the recognition part, but if you don't have an internet signal, or if your internet's cutting in and out, you type something, next thing you know, it says you don't have a signal, and it stops t- stops transcribing. You either have to type it manually or wait for your internet signal to jump back up. And that can be a real headache and hassle for some users.
Now, there was another big offline feature that came out I'm assuming it's coming out with 4.1.
No, it actually has already been rolled out, the new map feature, and that would be offline Google Maps. So if you use Google Maps on your Android device, check and see if you have a new update. And if you do, you may now have an option to press your menu key and then see make available offline.
Oh, that is fantastic.
Does that work into the Google navigation as well?
I'm not exactly sure on the navigation part, since that is kind of ties off of your GPS location. I would still think that you'd
still have
to
have a GPS signal, but not necessarily a internet signal.
Correct.
They are separate
correct.
Radios.
So I'll have to test that out
on
my own device.
Pretty much, as long as you're on the Earth, you probably have a GPS signal. Probably.
In theory.
Until the DoD shuts it down.
But I do think that it will be very good, especially for people that are staying in a small area or they know that they're going to have a dead signal when they get to a certain location.
Or if you're going somewhere where you're not going to have phone coverage, like if you're going to Europe and you don't want to be roaming, you just shut your phone off.
I'm just thinking from personal experience here in Northeast Florida, there's some areas out in the woods where it's difficult to get a signal even with some of the better networks like Verizon.
That's true.
I've seen my signal, disappear, even if it's only for a minute or so. If you're trying to get somewhere and you need that map and you can't get to it, it can be a real headache, because then you don't know how to get out from where you are.
It always happens in places where you don't want to be without a map.
Or don't know where you are. Right. You know, all these trees look the same.
Exactly. So what else did they do?
Well, they also are doing a little bit more with the Google Play Store. They already have the books, they have the movies, they have the apps, but now they're adding also TV shows and magazines, like big deal magazines, pretty much, the magazines people actually want to buy.
That makes sense.
I'm interested on the magazines, though, because they have Google Currents, which if y'all haven't used it yet, I played around with it a little bit, and I thought it was a really nice, essentially magazine-type app. So we'll see if they try to just kind of roll that into the Play Store now.
Is the Currents something that you purchase, or
it's a free app, and you can download free Currents, which are streams from the major magazine people like Popular Mechanics and stuff like that.
It makes sense. I mean, with it being a consumer device, it makes sense for them to be doing that. And like we talked about previously with Google TV, it's great that they're actually making these relationships with the content providers, because that's what they needed to do.
And it seems like once again they're kind of streamlining their services and saying, hey, let's roll all this stuff into Google Play and give users a more kind of iTunes type experience.
Yeah, and it makes sense too, the timing, because they also announced a major new hardware. Kevin.
Yes, big deal. This is the new Google's first ever made tablet that they've produced using Asus.
Nexus 7, right? Is what they're calling it?
Exactly, the Nexus 7. It has been likened a lot to the Kindle Fire, probably because of its low price point. You can get the 8 gigabyte version for just $200, $199.
Which is not bad.
That's a great price. No, it's a really good price.
Especially to have a full-blown Android tablet versus the limited.
Yeah, the Kindle. The fork that the Kindle Fire is, mm-hmm. which for our listeners, the Kindle Fire runs a version of Android, but not the official version. They've made their own
derivative. It's like
a custom derivative.
Version. Yeah, there's some things you really just can't do, and some things you can do that you may not even be able to do on a Google device.
Now, it has a great display.
Absolutely.
You were telling me about that.
Yeah, 1280 by 880 HD display. I mean, this is a pretty impressive display. And I'll tell you what, it is, the specs on this is pretty impressive too. It is a 1.3 gigahertz Tegra 3 chipset with a quad core CPU, and get this, a 12 core GPU.
That's insane for a mobile device.
Yeah, the GPU being, everybody knows a CPU is a processor, but the GPU is like a graphical processor.
Right.
So that's going to give it the ability to really perform graphically.
It seems like they're kind of gearing this almost like a mobile gaming
platform,
and
that's
really
a powerful gaming
they
device.
Really want that to be kind of a focus of this, and if not gaming, for video streaming and
right.
other types of really high quality, fast, smooth video, kind of going back to the whole Project Butter. Make it smooth, make it run well, make it clean, and people will like it.
And that price point, for the considering how impressive the hardware is, that's an amazing price point.
I know.
Their margin must be incredibly slim. Mm-hmm. They're making hardly anything on these things.
Now, what about the case? I mean, I know we've seen the iPad has the nice aluminum case, and now we've saw the Surface debut last week with their little
magnesium
case. So,
the case is just, it's molded plastic and rubber, but according to Phil Nickenson of Android Central, he said it feels solid. His only complaint was that if you press the screen really hard, the screen would get distorted, but most users would never experience that because they're not beating on their device.
Well, and most people's phones are plastic and molded rubber anyway, so...
So it's a little bit cheaper construction, but, for
it's only $200.
It's only $200, and that price point, man... That made me want to,
you
go ahead and get it.
You can get the 16-gigabyte versions for just $50 more as well. So
that's great.
If you think that the 8 gigabytes isn't going to last you, they definitely have the upgrade option. Plus, you're going to probably want to add about $30 for taxes, shipping, and handling.
Yeah.
But you can actually pre-order them now on the Google Play Store. I guess what we already talked about, the OS 4.1 Jelly Bean is going to be on this device, which is what I'm real excited about. It's a really nice device. It's got a front-facing camera, so you can do all your Skypes and video chatting. It is actually the first Android device with a Google Chrome as the default browser.
That was impressive, too. And like you were saying, Aaron, it's about time for that.
Yeah, it is about time. But the devices are there now. They can handle the full flash that Chrome supports. And it'll give the users the experience that you would expect from a Chrome browser, which I don't really think users would have gotten on some of the older hardware and operating system. It just would have been a little too choppy, I think. And that's kind of something that I think that they did good to wait on until this time when you have the quad core and... CPUs and that sort of hardware.
Yeah. Now, there was another hardware that they announced, the Nexus Q. What was that all about?
The Nexus Q, it's kind of a interesting device, and it's going to be interesting to see how successfully they market it, because it is a new experience, and that's a streaming device for streaming video, so social video and social audio. So the idea is that if you're in, say, a house party or something with somebody, you can upload a video from your account, they could upload a song from their account, and y'all can all add it to a central queue, and you can control it from Android devices. So everybody
in the room... So it plugs into the TV or your...
Yes, it would plug into your TV and your home entertainment system, and it allows users to stream their content through a central system.
Now, that sounds a lot like Google TV.
Not really. The Google TV is kind of a different device in a sense that Google TV is for streaming online content.
Okay.
So the Google TV is going to be in addition to your regular TV services. So you have, cable, satellite, something like that. Or you're just used to streaming online content. But it really piggybacks your TV signal. So you watch TV on this thing, you plug in your Google TV box, and it would give you streaming content. So like Netflix, Pandora, and they're still working out details, but hopefully Hulu as well, because I know a lot of users use that one. But with the Nexus Q, it's user-based. So there's really kind of a use for both. Although I'm interested on the price point, they're listing it at $299. So it's going to be curious to see how that compares to now the new Google TV boxes, like the new one from Vizio, the CoStar, which is dropping at $99 on the Vizio website. And that one even adds OnLive, which is a cloud-based gaming streaming service. So people that like gaming, but like the Netflix-type streaming experience, you can now stream video games to your TV through a $100 device. So people that are looking for a new gaming system, it might be something that they would look forward to.
And what does this thing look like?
I was actually reading an article, and RollingStones.com said that it looks like a little Death Star from Star Wars.
Well, let's see. Google also announced some new apps on iOS, surprisingly, during their announcement. On iPhone, they added Chrome, which was another one that was like, finally. So on the Chrome browser, you can use Chrome tabs. So if you're on your desktop, you can jump over to your iPhone or your iPad and pick up right where you were left off, pull up your tabs and see them on there, which is fantastic. Also, any bookmarks, you can share them back and forth. If you're logged into Chrome on your desktop, logged in on your iPad or your iPhone, you're good there too. And also, but the problem is it doesn't replace Safari as the default browser, which is really irritating.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, if I'm correct, doesn't it also run off the Safari core as well rather than a Chrome?
Yeah, it really is just Safari with a different face on it. So it's running the exact same way, but it runs adds new features to it.
So it's kind of like a Chrome skin for Safari at the moment.
Exactly. And you know, personally, I think Apple needs to be careful because if they keep up with this and they don't give us the option to change our default browser like you have with Android, they're going to be dealing with an antitrust case like Microsoft dealt with back in the 90s. And on a side note, last Wednesday, the General Court of the European Union upheld most of the original fine that they placed against Microsoft, but they did reduce it by, you know, 39 million euros to just a little bit less, 860 million euros, so about $1.1 billion.
Wow.
For a grand total of 1.64 billion euros, or roughly $2 billion. So it's cost Microsoft quite a bit. That gamble that they made that they could control the browser. So, you know, Apple better be careful. That's $10 billion in cash, that'll get spent up real quick when you get fines like that placed against you.
Yeah, I really haven't seen, as far as I know, of an antitrust lawsuit on a mobile device yet. So
I bet it's not long.
Then again, there really hasn't been a need for one until now with new third-party browsers. So it's really interesting to see how Apple responds to this.
Another thing that they announced was Google Drive app, which you can download anything on your iPhone or iPad that you've got stored in your Google Drive account. And that's it. No editing, no upload. Really, Google, why did you even bother?
Lame.
There are several apps in the App Store that have download and upload capability. It's like you're kicking me in the shins.
Well, on the bright side, though, you do now have an official Google-branded app, and that'll give the developers at Google a chance to kind of build off of that, and hopefully in the next revision, they'll give you the upload features as well.
Yeah, and there was one other thing. Unfortunately, at the end of this, they had a bad news placed against them. They got an injunction on Google against a Samsung Galaxy Nexus.
Really?
Apple had to put up a $96 million bond to start the trial, but they stopped the Galaxy Nexus from being sold in the U.S. So even though all the developers that were there got a Galaxy Nexus to use with Jelly Bean on it, nobody else is going to be able to use it until this trial is settled. So that's unfortunate. End of bad news on top of a really great week for Google. But we've got to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be taking some of your questions. Up next, we'll be taking your calls, reading your emails, and answering your questions. If you have a tech question for Deemable Tech, give us a call at 904-372-DEEM. That's 904-372-3336. Or send us an email to questions@deemable.com. Welcome back to Deemable Tech. Now, we got some questions to cover, but before we do that, actually, there was one other news story I wanted to talk about. Last week, we talked about Facebook having a new feature called Find My Friends. And we were actually pretty excited about it because it gave you the opportunity to share or become a friend with somebody just because you're in the same room. So both of you went to this page and it would show both of you there and you click on it. So you didn't have to search for people. But almost immediately after we wrapped up the episode, news broke that Facebook had pulled the plug on it.
They yanked it.
Yeah, and it was weird because a spokesperson from Facebook told Wired that this wasn't a formal release. This was just something that a few engineers were testing. With all the tests, some get released as full products and other don't. Nothing more to say on this for now, but we'll communicate to everyone when there is something to say. What I thought was interesting, though, here at Deemable, we seem to be the only news outlet that didn't trash the feature as being creepy or as Facebook's new stalker feature. And apparently a lot of folks didn't understand that you had to choose to have that feature open. It wasn't just automatic. You had to go to that page and turn it on, and it was only on while you were on that page. But a lot of folks were skeptical, and I guess that makes sense because lately, Facebook has gotten into a little bit of trouble with their changes.
Yeah, didn't they change all their everybody's email addresses back in November?
Yeah, actually, in November of 2010, if you hadn't already done so, Facebook asked users to pick a username. And what happened was they were launching a Facebook email service. Most people didn't really notice it, or if they noticed, they didn't really care because they didn't need or want another email service to manage and deal with. But last week, apparently Facebook decided to get more people to use the service, or they thought that's what's going to happen. And they changed everyone's default email address in Facebook to your Facebook email address. So did you notice that?
I did notice that. Well, it was somebody brought it to my attention.
Yeah, it wasn't until I read the news about it. I was like,
my own.
So right now, if you sign into Facebook and click on your name on the left-hand side, and then click About or Update Info, and then scroll down to Contact Info, you'll see your fancy Facebook email address, even if you had another address that you wanted people to contact you at.
Now, they didn't take those email addresses away, and I think that's something
right.
that we need to make sure our listeners are aware of, too. They basically just hid them.
Right.
And they defaulted where your only visible email address is now your Facebook one. So you still have the ability to go in there and turn the visibility on for your friends
True.
Or for other people. For your personal email address. And in a way, I think it was good because it's kind of like your phone number. You don't necessarily want your phone number defaulting to everybody on Facebook. You might only want it to go to your friends or to your close friends.
Right. They actually said that the reason was for privacy concerns because then you're not, just sharing out your email address. And for most people, it probably wouldn't have an impact. But for instance, if I only have your email address, Kevin, because mm-hmm. I have it on Facebook and it's tied into my iPhone, and I have it, synchronized there, all of a sudden, I don't have your email address anymore. I've just got your @facebook.com email address.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that they should have done a little bit.
That irritated a lot of people.
I think they should have done a little bit more of a customer ability to change it. So kind of have a pop-up that says, hey, we're
Would
changing.
Would you like to change it
we're
to
changing
Facebook?
This new email system. Click here to hide all email addresses except for your Facebook one.
Right.
Or they could have actually just had it forward to the email that you chose, and that way it would still be hidden from everybody else. But if somebody sent you an email,
kind of going back to Ray's point, though, they wanted people to use their service, and they were almost forcing people to try it in a way, like, hey, we'll make everybody try it, and if they don't like it, they can switch back.
Now, if you don't want that to be the email address that you share on Facebook, just go into your contact info, click edit, and you can change it to whatever address you want to be shared, which is ironic because my Facebook email address is facebook@rayhollister.com. And when they changed it, it changed it to rayhollister@facebook.com. So that was kind of confusing because it looked the same when you glanced at it real quick. All right. And in other social networking news, or actually, no, I guess this is not social network news. Google wants everyone to stop calling Google Plus a social network. One thing that Google wants everyone to stop doing, really, is comparing its social network, Google Plus, to other social networks, because apparently Google Plus is not a social network. That was a very confusing sentence. I just realized that. Vic Gundotra, Google's senior vice president of social business, told Mashable that Google Plus is just an upgrade to Google. People have a hard time understanding that. I think they like to compare us with other social competitors, and they see us through that lens instead of really seeing what's happening. Google is taking its amazing products, and by bringing them together, They just become more awesome. And there's an irony there. He says, compare us with other social competitors. So if there are other social competitors, he's saying that he's also a social network.
Well, they've gotten into the social network category, if you will, with Google Plus, but Google Plus itself is not a social network. It's an extension of the Google family. So you have a Gmail, you have a YouTube account. You're only one step away from becoming a Google Plus user by essentially activating your Google Plus features.
Right, and it just pulls it all into one stream.
And it's also more designed to network with the people that you're already communicating with. So these are people that are in your address book, whereas Facebook and some of the other ones like MySpace are more designed to find people,
right,
to search for people and connect with them.
It's not like you're joining something brand new and you have to recreate all these things that you have elsewhere. It's already services that Google provides. They're just pulling it all together into one place. So his argument is somewhat valid because it really isn't a separate social network.
I can see how some people would just think it's kind of a cop-out. Maybe they were afraid, you know, that they didn't overtake Facebook in the first, you know, 6 months or so. And
I mean, the question is how many of Google's users are actually using the service? And I think that's what they're trying to avoid.
Well, and what is a social network at that point, you know?
So. That's true. Because, I mean, you know, you could say, well, all of YouTube's users are Google Plus users, or they might be. All of Gmail's users are Google Plus users, or they might be. So it's kind of hard to measure it, to compare it apples to apples, you know. Well, mm-hmm. I guess you shouldn't say apples to apples, because that's their competitor. Their other competitor.
Google's to apples.
There you go. But let's deal with some questions here. Actually, last week we got an email from Gary asking what the best practices for passwords was. But we didn't really have enough time to really answer his question in depth, so we wanted to talk about it more this week. And his email was, lately in the news it seems that all these sites like LinkedIn are getting hacked, and I've been hearing everybody talk about how you're supposed to have a separate password for each website that you go to, but how are you supposed to keep track of all these different passwords? I'm not using something dumb like 123ABC or password as my password, but there's no way I could remember a separate password for each site. I use a fairly tough password with random letters and numbers, and isn't that good enough?
Well, you know, there are some good common password recommendations. You know, you should, you know, never share a computer account with anybody, so you know you're the only one that does know your password.
Right.
You should never use the same password for more than one account.
To stop, pause on that for just a second. That applies to everybody. If mm-hmm. you are married, have a separate account on Facebook from your spouse.
Yeah.
You know, if you're even if you're married, I mean, like maybe if you're married, you could get away with that. But for teenagers who are sharing passwords on their Facebook accounts, that is so dumb, because I mean, that is your identity, and anything you do could legally be held against you mm-hmm. on Facebook, and you'd have to prove, oh no, it wasn't me, it was my girlfriend, or it was my boyfriend, whatever, and that's just really not a smart move.
Well, I don't think kids are going to go to jail over it. They'll just shut down their Facebook
maybe.
account.
I mean, it's according to what they do.
I guess.
And of course, there are different rules for home versus corporate. This part we're going to talk about first is really just for home users. We'll talk about the corporate end of things in a minute. Mm-hmm. But tell some more of those recommendations, Kevin.
Well, you know, you just never tell your passwords to anybody. I mean, it's pretty simple stuff. You know, they say never write down a password, but I mean, I've even heard a little bit differently. You know, I mean, if you wrote down your password if for home users, anyway, I guess, you know, maybe that might be more towards the business users, like you said. But you know, if you wrote down your password and somebody's taking advantage of that, well, then you probably have bigger problems. Somebody might be in your house.
Something to keep in mind with that. If you are going to write down a password as a home user, don't be dumb and keep it near the computer.
Sure.
Just, you know, keep it somewhere safe. Put it in your lockbox with all of your, you know, family documents and things. Don't tape it to the bottom of your keyboard.
Right.
Because that's the first place people are going to look if they want a password.
But like Kevin was saying, though, good point is if someone's in your house reading that piece of paper, you've got a bigger problem than your password being gone.
Not necessarily. I mean, depending on what people do at home, a lot of people now have home-based businesses. You may have a house that's worth $100,000 and a $2 million business on your computer.
That's true.
So there is still something to be said about that password being
secure. What
I'm
saying is, if they're looking at that piece of paper, they're probably just going to take the computer.
Oh, yeah.
So, you're
going to go, okay, I need to file a police report and change all my passwords. So
very true.
Also, don't share passwords by telephone or email or instant messaging.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you know, make sure that you log off your computer when you walk away from it. And if you ever suspect that your password has been compromised, of course, change it. Another example of computer gets stolen.
That kind of brings up another point, and that is the importance of your email password versus your other passwords, your bank account password, Facebook, etc. Something that I've found to be kind of a general rule of thumb is make sure that your email password is something different than all of your other passwords. Even if you do make them all the same, always make your email different for this reason. The easiest way to reset a password or change it is it's going to send it to your email. So if somebody has control of your email, they have literally control of every account, even if they're different passwords, because all they'll have to do is say, I don't know my password, and it'll send it to your email.
Yep.
So it's really important in this day and age of technology to make sure that your email password is even more secure than your bank and other things, because a bank will actually, if it's been proven that it was a stolen case, will give you your money back. They'll put the money back in your account, but you can't get something like that for email. It's just personal information.
So now, again, these are kind of advice for home users. For work users, there's different policies that apply. Each corporation that you work for has their own policies for their applications. For instance, you know, you may have an application that you have to use at work that requires that you use all capital and only letters, and only 8 characters, which is actually a fairly insecure password. But even if the policy is stupid, you have to follow it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of true with some websites and applications you use.
Yeah, I think that's one of the concerns of a lot of users. Like they have a real good password they think is secure. It's got numbers, it's got letters, it's got special characters. But then you get to these websites that don't even allow you to have a character, or it doesn't allow you to have numbers.
And that's often
and so
true
it's,
with
it's actually making your password less secure. Plus, it's, you know, you have to think of a different password that's not the same as your other. So people are having a hard time keeping track. What would you recommend? Do you use anything specific?
Well, yeah, I actually use LastPass, it is fantastic for that. I have over 300 different sites that I have passwords for. And I can tell you that more than 75% of them have a unique password.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way I could keep track of all of them. So LastPass is amazing because I do pay $12 a year for it, so I can have it on my iPhone and my iPad, but I can keep track of all my passwords. I can pull them up on here. I can even log in automatically with them on the browser, on the desktop, or on the phone.
And it's free if you just
want to
use it on your
computer. If you don't
want to
use it on mobile,
yeah.
Just use it on the computer.
Yeah, and of course, to make sure, you know, if you are using it in a corporate environment, that the corporation will allow use of such software.
They'll let you. At my work, I was able to for a while, and then when there was a recent scare that it may have been compromised, they said, absolutely not, you can't use it. So also, unlike home users, work users should never write down their password. There's just too many people walking by, especially if you're in your cubicle environment, where someone could just see your password and grab it. Because most of the time when there is problems where data is being corrupted or not corrupted, but someone is hacking into it, it's unfortunately usually somebody you work with.
Compromised.
Yeah, when it's compromised. Thank you. That's the word I was looking for. Also, never use a password at work that you use for your private accounts.
Oh, absolutely.
Keep those separate. Because, like what happened with LinkedIn recently, if your password is compromised, so is all your corporate information. Yeah. All your corporate accounts are compromised as well because they've got your password now. And amazed at how quickly people know where you work.
Oh, yeah. Well, and it's one thing to have to, you know, change things on a personal level, you know, change your Facebook, change your Gmail. When you have to explain to your boss that somebody got into his corporate network and he had to have IT security, you know, check into something because your personal Facebook got hacked.
Yeah.
Then you might be in a little bit of the hot seat.
That's an awkward conversation to have. Let's see. So yeah, always keep those separate. So, you know, there's a lot of different advice that we could give about this. And there is no cut and dry answer for every situation, unfortunately.
Honestly, the best one I tell my customers as a consultant is to try to keep three. You know, three is usually enough that people can remember. So you have one that you use for all of your personal stuff that's very difficult to crack, that's, you know, something that only you would know. You have something different from your work that, you know, that you use just for your corporate setting. And then, of course, that you have something for just your email. Like I was saying before, if your email gets compromised, everything gets compromised, even if it hasn't got compromised yet. So making sure that you have that completely separate from all of your other accounts. So if they do get into one, they won't try that email, that password on your email to try to get access to everything else.
True.
And another thing, you know, like you were saying, if you have three passwords, I think one thing I've actually done before, because I've had two or three different passwords, especially being married and having to remember my wife's passwords now, you know. So I got crazy passwords running through my head.
Didn't I just get done saying don't use your wife's password?
Well, I just know her password for her account. We don't have the same account.
My wife uses pretty
when
much
you're,
the
when
same
you're a
password
tech guy and your wife's always bringing you stuff and saying, honey, fix this.
Exactly.
Yeah. You're going to know it.
It's true.
Sometimes I have to
pay her
bills.
And that's why I said,
bills.
You know, the exception, if there is an exception to the rule of don't share your password with anybody, the only people who could possibly meet that exception is your spouse or your lawyer. Because both of them have an investment in you and represent you. You know, your wife does something, you could be held liable for it. So, you know, I guess it's okay.
But as I was saying, I've even done it. If I wanted to really just make something a really secure thing, I would take two of those passwords I've had in the past and just actually put them together, sure. Making an entirely new password and stronger than ever.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Tom's not here to elaborate on that today, but he was actually mentioning last week how the new train of thought is that longer is better. So
yeah,
instead
true.
Of trying to combine special characters and uppercase and lowercase and, well, which letter did I capitalize? Which number did I use? That now, you know, something that's long and difficult to crack with the software that's out there would be something that has a lot of characters.
Like you mentioned last week, something, you know, like goat milk cow, or no, goat milk cow actually probably wouldn't be a great one, but goat orange wheelbarrow, you know, something, even though it could be a dictionary attack, it's so long that it's not gonna happen.
Or things that are completely unrelated, you know, lightning pig laptop, you know, husband, you know,
right.
Four completely random words,
and you want to make sure it's something that somebody couldn't think of when they talked to you or find out from information online.
Yes, you know. if you see it in a book, if it's online, if you use it in daily conversation, that would not be a good password.
Right. All right, well, that is all the time we have for today. Now, we have received a bunch of emails with a lot of questions, so next week, we are only going to answer your questions. We're not going to cover any news next week. Hopefully, there won't be any huge stories that we'll miss out on. But if you have a question for us, be sure and send us your email or give us a call, and we might use it on the show. Our producer is Sean Birch. I'm Ray Hollister.
I'm Kevin Clark.
I'm Aaron Edelson.
And this is Deemable Tech. Thanks for listening. Have a great week.